and welcome back. Some might say pandas are natural born celebrities, and they are right. In China's Sichuan province, 10 panda cubs have made their first public debut, with throngs of journalists and photographers watching their every move. All of the adorable creatures, which are not named yet, were born in 2020 at a Wulong Conservation and Research Center. Their age ranges from just 120 to 190 days. Each of the cubs has a weight of about 10 kilograms. Over the past year, a total of 44 panda cubs were born around the globe.
79-year-old Siberian grandmother ice skates on frozen Lake Baikal to look after her cows, or just to have some fun. Novoshov Morkodova has lived alone by the world's oldest and deepest lake since her husband died in 2011. Her daily routine consists of chopping wood and carrying buckets of water from an ice hole, keeping cows and regularly hitting the ice. Lubushov uses a pair of steel skates made by her father 76 years ago to check on her cows when they walk too far from her house. When asked why she likes skating, the babushka said because her heart longs for it.
I need my skates for various things. I need them to run errands, and I need them for fun, to have a skate or to look for my cows. I can ice skate here and there when walking through the snow is hard. I skate to a direction looking for my cows, and when I see they're not there, I skate to another part and find them roaming there. I call them and they return home, just like that. And without chores, when I just want to ice skate, I can do it.
Even the strong winds, unrelenting cold, and constant hard work don't deter Lubushov Morkodova, whose name translates as love walking on the sea. Since her husband's death, she has been resisting calls from her family to move back to the city. Lake Baikal is often frozen over for half of the year, and the septuagenarian believes skating on it is the secret to her longevity.
Two giant pandas at a zoo in Washington take full advantage of the winter season and have a blast playing in the snow. The animals' pure joy, caught on camera, could melt even the iciest hearts. In a clip shared by the zoo, the adorable panda bears are seen rolling, sliding, and tumbling around in the snow. The zookeepers say the pair's five-month-old male cub also experienced his first encounter with snow. They say he even took a little nip at the fresh powder. However, he only spent a few minutes outside his indoor habitat. This national zoo is currently closed to visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic, but its panda cam is available for all to enjoy.
Conservationists have rescued a third giraffe from the flooding island of Lake Baringo off Kenya. The daring rescue was the third such operation since the area was hit with intense rain, threatening the survival of the trapped animals. Two other maroon giraffes were transferred to safety in December. Local rangers say the animals are trained before being moved, so they don't need to tranquilize them. They say six other Rothschild's giraffes are still stranded on the shrinking island.
We still have quite a number, six actually giraffes, including the recent young one which was born in December. This is a process that we are trying to look at a case or day-by-day scenario. You know, the moment we train these remaining giraffes, the moment they are ready, we move them. But
the target is to move these animals by... The rangers say they plan to complete moving all the giraffes to a purpose-built sanctuary on the mainland by no later than May. Today there are fewer than 3,000 Rothschild's giraffes in Africa, with 800 of them living in Kenya.
The sniffing abilities of dogs are being put to the test at a leading French veterinary laboratory where dogs are being trained to detect the coronavirus. Five dogs from the canine brigades of the French National Gendarmerie have been training since early January. They sniff at a number of vessels, each containing a piece of cloth with human sweat. Some samples are from patients with COVID-19, negative donors, or even neutral scents. When the canine shows interest in a vessel with a COVID-19 sample, it is rewarded.
It will soon be necessary to screen asymptomatic people in all kinds of spaces, schools, nursing homes, which must continue to be better understood and defined, and airports. This type of tool, which makes it possible to offer at least one strong criterion of suspicion, will facilitate the whole process in terms of user friendliness, accessibility, and reactivity.
Well, the dog's keen sense of smell is said to be able to detect the coronavirus in 95% of positive cases. It's hoped that the canines will be able to detect COVID-positive people even if they show no symptoms. The animals can be used as a non-invasive way of testing for the viral infection, as well as many other life-threatening illnesses. Igloo, a dome-shaped structure made of snow and ice, gives us an idea of the Inuit of Arctic. But hang on. The ski resort hotel in Indian-controlled Kashmir has come up with a similar idea to attract visitors. The Kolahoy Green Heights has an igloo cafe where tourists can enjoy hot drinks and food in sub-zero temperatures. Even the tables in the Eskimo-style cafe are made of ice and snow. As many as 16 people can sit and chill out in the igloo at any given time. The icy cafe is 25 feet around. Unlike those on the Arctic, this particular igloo has elements of local architecture, like an arched door and patterns on the curved walls.
A French-Swiss artist spray paints a huge fresco on the grounds of Cape Town as part of a global project aimed at fostering unity in a polarized world. The 31-year-old artist tries to convey his message of togetherness in his movement called Beyond Walls. The project consists of frescoes depicting two hands clasping each other's forearms around the world. South Africa's Cape Town represents an essential step of the project due to its history marked by apartheid. The self-taught artist says he wants to create the biggest human chain in the world, and Cape Town is his ninth step.
Because for me, I really trust that it's only together that humanity can respond to the biggest challenge of our time. And this is this message that I want to do by making huge fresco with biodegradable paint directly on the grass. It is a worldwide project, and the idea is to create the biggest human chain to speak about togetherness. And today in Cape Town, this is the ninth step of this project.
Sipe uses paint made out of charcoal, chalk, water, and milk proteins to create his art, making it eco-friendly. He was also named one of the most influential young artists by Forbes magazine for his art, which is best viewed from aerial footage. His temporary biodegradable images have been previously painted on lawns in eight cities, including Paris, Andorra, Geneva, Berlin, Ouagadougou, and Istanbul. And a parade of classic and vintage cars has enlivened the streets of French capital Paris. About 700 vehicles of various eras drove through the streets of Paris, passing its landmarks such as the Eiffel Tower. Different vehicles, including cars, buses, and motorcycles, took part in the show. It was the 21st edition of the parade that takes place twice a year. The event is the most important one for old car enthusiasts in France. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bafizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, Bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kaz batre, batre ye khun paake shoma, Mi ruyad, ta
the limelight. U.S. accuses China's COMAC of military-civil fusion, but that won't stop the rising airplane maker from taking global market share, says Scott Foster, writer, in an article published under the heading, China's Jets Set to Challenge Boeing and Airbus. Stay tuned for the details, please. Aerospace is one of the key industries targeted by Beijing's Made in China 2025 drive. Could this become a problem for Boeing, Airbus, and other non-Chinese suppliers of aircraft, aircraft engines, and other related equipment? The outgoing Donald Trump administration apparently thought so. In mid-January, it put Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, COMAC, on its list of companies tied to the Chinese military. This prevents Americans from investing in COMAC, although they would probably not do so anyway. COMAC is not publicly traded and has issued bonds only in the Chinese domestic market. The Pentagon is concerned about China's military-civil fusion development strategy, an alarming business model similar to those of Boeing, Raytheon, and other American companies that serve both military and civilian markets. Military-civil fusion has even become an American acronym, MCF, raising it to the level of official Washington, D.C., claptrap. As the Center for a New American Security reports, MCF has emerged as a key analytic driver of the intensifying economic and technological competition between the United States and the PRC in recent years. China's MCF, however, is misunderstood, and its success is hardly a foregone conclusion. So is COMAC a threat or not? COMAC may be added to America's entity list, meaning its American suppliers would have to receive special licenses from the Commerce Department in order to ship their products to COMAC. This could be very serious, since without key American components, COMAC airplanes could not fly. Its American suppliers include engine makers Pratt & Whitney and CFM International, avionics suppliers Honeywell and Rockwell Collins, PPG Aerospace Materials, and others. COMAC was established in 2008 by the Aviation Industry Corporation of China, Aluminum Corporation of China, Bao Steel Group Corporation, Shanghai Gusheng Corporation, an investment company, and the State-Owned Assets Supervision and Administration Commission of the State Council, that is SASAC. SASAC has a majority stake in COMAC. COMAC is not controlled by the Chinese military, but it is an instrument of national policy. As stated on its website, the Party Committee of SASAC performs the responsibilities mandated by the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. COMAC now has two products, the ARJ-21 Regional Jet, ARJ stands for Advanced Regional Jet, and the C-919 Narrowbody Single Aisle Jet Aircraft. The ARJ-21 is a 78 to 90 seat passenger plane with a range of 2,225 to 3,700 kilometers. The first delivery was made in 2015 to Chengdu Airlines, which started commercial flights the following year. China's Global Times reports that close to 50 ARJ21s are now in service and that more than 20 were produced last year. According to COMAC's website, a total of 616 orders have been obtained from 23 customers. The C919 is a 156 to 168 seat passenger plane with a range of 4,075 to 5,555 kilometers. It is undergoing flight tests now, with the first deliveries to China Eastern Airlines scheduled to be made by the end of this year. According to COMAC, a total of 815 orders have been obtained from 28 customers. The ARJ21 competes with regional jets made by Embraer of Brazil, Bombardier of Canada, and, if it can ever get its space jet into service, Mitsubishi Aircraft Corporation of Japan. The C919 will compete with Airbus A320 and Boeing 737 aircraft. In 2017, COMAC and United Aircraft Corporation, UAC of Russia, formed the China-Russia Commercial Aircraft International Co., LTD, that is CRAIC, to jointly develop a long-range wide-body aircraft that will be assembled in Shanghai. This is the CR-929, a 280-seat wide-body, dual-aisle passenger jet with a range of 12,000 kilometers. It is intended to compete with Boeing and Airbus long-haul aircraft, initially in China, Russia, and the CIS, and eventually in the global market. Manufacturing is scheduled to start this year. UAC was established in 2006 through the merger of Russian aircraft manufacturers Ilyushin, Irkut, Myokin, Sukhoi, Topolov, and Yakolov. Primarily a defense contractor today, it aspires to become a major supplier of commercial aircraft as Ilyushin and Topolov were in Soviet times.
Aperture.
In 2003, America entered into a war with a country its citizens could barely locate on the map. War was initiated to find Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, something that was never found and actually never even existed. Yet the American invasion of Iraq let the genie out of the bottle, resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths, the destruction of a whole nation, and insecurity and instability for a region which has continued until this day. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. As Washington's beating of the war drums raged, Lorna Tychostoup, a single mother and news and politics editor for a local arts magazine in New York, knowingly risks her life, imprisonment, and even $1 million fine by traveling to Iraq under the threat of war, and on a mission to capture and bring back the face of the Iraqi people for the American public to see. Stay with us for this week's extraordinary and inspiring documentary as Lorna returns with images of ordinary Iraqis that she hopes will sway people against this invasion.
then, honestly, I wasn't sure where Iraq was on the map. Nobody I knew where Iraq was on the map. I had never met an Iraqi person. And all I thought was, like, what do they look like? We're going to be killing them. We're going to go to war in a country that I know nothing about. And why? And I really had this sense that if I took enough pictures and I got them in enough places and I showed enough people who the United States would be killing, who we, America, would be killing, that it might help to stop the war from happening. I don't know. I guess I've always been this way. You know, speaking out, I always felt like I was riding the cusp of history. I was watching, I was living history.
You saw the television news pictures of last Saturday's anti-war protest. No one disputes that it was sizable and that, for the most part, it was peaceful.
The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. Any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
What if your wife or your mother told you that she was headed to Iraq for 2 weeks? Well, three New York moms who call themselves the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade are headed there tomorrow for a 10-day mission of what they're describing as peace. Are you going to ask them, why did you guys ignore 17 UN resolutions? Why did you guys wait 12 years? Why do you refuse to disarm your nuclear program, your biological and chemical program? Do you plan on asking them that?
No, I don't. I'm going there to see the people. I'm going there because these people aren't going to be liberated. They're going to be annihilated.
This is left-wing propaganda. You know what? America freed the world from the Nazis. We freed the world from totalitarianism, the former Soviet Union. We freed the world of fascism. And we're going to free these people, the ones you care about. They're going to be liberated.
Listen, I think that when you start dividing it into left and right, that's not the issue here.
But you are a leftist.
Why are we here discussing what our labels are? You can label me anything you want to diminish my argument. I don't want to go to Iraq. I'm going to Iraq because, you know, I feel the people like you, the people who have the money, the networks that have the power, how come they're not going to this country and showing us? They only show us the maniac. They don't show us the faces of the people.
Well, he is a maniac.
People,
I mean, he is a maniac.
Children.
Let's not put that aside.
But
he is a maniac.
There are families there. I would tell our government to please let the weapons inspectors continue to do their job.
Ladies, I wish you get home safe before the war starts, because war is coming. And I mean that sincerely. I hope you get back safe. And coming up, Secretary Ridge raised the threat level to high today. Does this mean you should stay home and lock the doors?
You know, I had always wanted to be on that show. Because I'll sit here and watch Fox, you know, Hannity and Combs, and want to throw my shoe at the TV half the time. Because they get people, they interrupt them, they berate them, they just get their message, right. So instead, I interrupted them.
Okay, my name is Lorna Tychasta. I'm going to Baghdad because, as a photojournalist, I feel it is my responsibility to go there and bring home the face of the Iraqi people to the American public.
I was wondering if you're concerned about being a casualty of your own government.
I think that right now we're all collateral damage. The Wall Street Journal's poll, 73% of the people in this country do not want unilateral attack of Iraq. We love our country. We live here too. We are three mothers. We've got six kids between us. We love those kids. We want to come home.
The community here has been unbelievably supportive, I think partly because these three women are so brave and bold. But, you know, a lot of people can't go to Iraq. A lot of people can't leave their lives. These three people are risking their lives to go to make a very powerful statement.
You're going to Iraq? What?
I'm going to Iraq.
Really?
So that's why they're filming me.
Why are you going to Iraq?
I met Lorna maybe 10 years ago. She was a single mom working as a waitress at a local restaurant.
Because we're going to go there as, you know, I'm a journalist, so I'm going to go and take some
brave
pictures and bring home some photos and
very brave.
Hopefully maybe stop this war insanity.
Lorna is the editor of the political section of Chronogram, a local magazine of arts, culture, politics, kind of the village voice of the Hudson Valley. Lorna has charisma. She has loads of charisma. Lorna has not gone to journalism school. Lorna has not gone to charm school. What Lorna brings to any situation is this almost animal ferocity. She goes after a story like it's nobody's business. She doesn't stop. She'll keep calling people. She wants to know why. Lorna's somebody who knows how to take care of herself very well. And she had said explicitly to me, I have two kids. I love my life. If the war starts to happen, I'm coming home.
My daughter, Lacey, she's 18 and a half years old. My son, Josh, is 22 and a half years old. They both go to the University of Binghamton. They're not happy. You know, they're afraid for me. They're afraid for them. Years ago, like in 95, I traveled in Mexico and I kind of fell into the Zapatista revolution. So I came home and I told them about that. So they've been kind of living like this is what their crazy mom, you know, does.
She's always wanted to go places and see things that I guess she felt that people should see. So I guess you just kind of have to go with it.
The pressure, gosh, the pressure of my kids, that is killer. You know, I know my daughter does not want me to go to Iraq.
Like, whose mom goes over there and why? I mean, besides stuff you see on TV, it's not really something typical of people you know.
I got married very young, and I got married, for ridiculous reasons, because I was trying to please and obtain love from my mother. So I did all the good things. I got married, and then a couple of years later, you're supposed to have kids. I paid my dues. Like, I want to do things that I want to do.
She always told us from when we were younger that whatever we wanted to do, we could do it. We wanted to be a coal miner or an artist or whatever. That she would be supportive. It's interesting now that whatever she's doing, I'll support, but I guess that's how it works. She's like definitely an irreplaceable person.
The only road all the way across the desert. I've been told that this is a 12-hour journey. The driver drives 100 miles an hour. This for me is probably the scariest part of the trip. Because it looks like it's a vast wilderness of unknown territory. And we're going to end up in Baghdad. I always wanted to go and go to places and see for myself and maybe bring back whatever I saw. I shot 45 rolls of black and white, 30 rolls of color. I get very close to people even if I don't have more than a split second to take their shot. I mean, I live with them after that. I take the shot and then later I see them develop. And they develop within me and I carry them around. February 15th, we had a 200-person international march for peace. We joined the rest of the world. And at one point, it was really interesting. I mean, somebody turned around to me, and they were like, wow, this is like it. Like, the epicenter of the peace movement comes from Baghdad. And then, of course, you know, to go back to the hotel later that night and find out that, you know, 20 to 30 million people around the world had been doing the same thing.
Today in London, 2 million people have marched against this war. That is one out of every 25 human beings in Britain. In Rome, as we speak, there are another 2 million people marching. And in Spain, the third of George Bush's allies in Europe, there are 1 million people marching against the war.
What's up, New York?
NBC producers that I spoke to, she said that at noon on February 15th in New York City, where all these millions of people were totally shutting down,
vast amount of blocks. They get a little phone call from NBC saying to cut the live feed.
Our next guest just returned from a two-week peace mission in Iraq. We want to welcome Lorna Tychosta back to the show.
You came back from Baghdad. You stayed there for how long? 2 weeks?
I was in Baghdad.
Okay, now, in my opinion, you seem like a lovely woman, but in my opinion, your visit bordered on treason. What were you thinking going there?
Oh, please. You know, I'm an American. I have a constitution. What makes you think that I should not be able to travel someplace on this planet? We have freedom of speech. This is a free country. You're telling me that this is treason?
If you oppose America's policies, that's fine. You can protest here all you want because that's free speech protected under the First Amendment. That's fine.
No, I'm an American.
But to carry your protest to enemy territory when we are on the eve of war seems to me villainous and bordering on treason.
Well, that makes great play here on TV.
Was aiding and abetting the enemy?
Absolutely not. I'm an American.
My going there was illegal. So what is it? $1 million up to $1 million and 12 years in jail for going someplace and bringing back the truth?
And I guess it comes down to the fact that if we were all sitting here and we were about to be bombed, I'd certainly want some group to rise up and make it not happen.
I'm in the process of setting up a college tour. I'll go around the country even if I have to and show these photos. And I really think that even people who want war, once they look at these photos, there will be people who will change their minds.
There's nothing in the country.
They have raw sewage floating in the streets. With such poverty, such desolation. You can see the stress in the eyes of every Iraqi person. You see this exhaustion and this fear. And the American public has to go and see. I think they have to go to Iraq and see this for themselves. Don't listen to me. You know, don't take my word on it.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. We will defend our freedom. We will bring freedom to others, and we will prevail. May God bless our country and all who defend her.
I believe in war. I believe there are times when you need to defend your land, your home. I don't think this was one of those times.
I was actually in the dark room the night that we started bombing.
It kind of stunned me that at that point, like a silence swept across the land. It stunned me that I felt I wanted to be silent too. If any of them are dead, they'll still live.
And I think that's why I made so many, so that like everybody who has them, in some way, they won't be forgotten.
I wanted it to be true that the Iraqis were happy we were there, that the fighting was going to stop now, and that we could have peace and things would be better. Like a little kid, I wanted it to be okay.
In Baghdad today, the search continued for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
So growing concern here, they won't find the massive quantities of weapons that were the major justification for the war.
The one thing I felt was missing from my work were the stories of the soldiers. That summer, I drove to North Carolina to Camp Lejeune to interview Marines. Half of what I do, or more than half of what I do, is because I take it to the personal. Like, I don't want my kids going to fight some old rich man's war. Are these Americans who are so frightened that they're sending these children off to fight for them, are they willing to look at the photographs that they bring home of the dead bodies that they've killed? We don't want to look. We don't want to see. Send them off. Let somebody else fight for us so that we'll... I think that that's a crime. I think that's a criminal activity. What do we do? You know, what do we...
We should never win it.
We should never win
it. Good. And just let the country go.
My son was in the invasion when we invaded Iraq in the beginning of the war. He was a driver of a 3rd Humvee in line going to Baghdad. His battalion was part of the battalion that got pinned down in Nasiriyah for 11 days in a firefight. During the war, didn't sleep. I became a CNN Fox News addict. Finally, I just had to turn the TVs off. He came back with 11 ribbons, a lot of souvenirs, a lot of pictures. A lot of nightmares. To this day, he still has them. because you don't hear anything about the guys that came back, what's missing the legs, the arms, and stuff like that. You know, there's nothing in the media, there's nothing in the newspapers, nobody talks about it. What are you going to do? You know? Say a prayer.
You know, I went in the beginning to bring home the face of the Iraqi people. Now I want to go and bring home the face of the soldiers, because that's got to hit home here.
The armored personnel vehicle that I drove around with, I went out on patrol. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is probably the worst experience of my entire life. So we rode around in this heavy-duty tin can that was spewing diesel fuel out of here. Over here, there's a hatch that you can stick your head out of. You want to see the bullets and mortars coming at you. There was no heater in the vehicle. They had had a heater. It had broken. You know, these guys are driving around. It's very cold there, and they don't need your goddamn ribbon. They need you to send them some money for a heater, or at least to write your congressmen and your congresswomen and say, could you please make sure our troops are being taken care of over there? And they need letters. They need emails. They love it. They want to know that America even knows they're there. So we rode around the village, you know, waiting to be shot at. You know, we got back around 11 o'clock in the next morning. That night when I tried to sleep, my body hurt more than it's ever hurt from any flu I've ever had in my entire life. And I think it was a combination of riding around in a heavy-duty tin can and also that I had poisoned myself with adrenaline. Because at any given moment, we were told, you know, we could be shot at.
How do they feel?
They're out in the streets. I spoke to some who are terrified. They're being shot at. They're under threat of mortars landing on their bases, car bombs going off around them. You know, most of the ones I spoke to want to come home. And do you know that there's a law that that the Bush administration has enforced? The Clinton administration didn't enforce it, that you cannot film or in any way capture the caskets with the flags on them. We're not allowed to see this. The media is not allowed to capture these images. That's a good question. Well, I don't know. Why? Should you not be seeing death on your TV?
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump lost the 2020 election largely because of his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, according to a post-election autopsy completed by Trump campaign pollster Tony Fabrizio. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalist Josh Dorsey. The piece is titled "Poor Handling of Virus Cost Trump His Re-election: Campaign Autopsy Finds." Stay with us for more of Josh Dorsey's article. Former President Donald Trump lost the 2020 election largely because of his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, according to a post-election autopsy completed by Trump campaign pollster Tony Fabrizio. The 27-page document shows that voters in 10 key states rated the pandemic as their top voting issue, and President Joe Biden won higher marks on the topic. The report also indicates that Donald Trump lost ground among key demographic groups that he needed. The internal report cuts against Trump's claims that the election was stolen from him and that Biden could not have fairly beaten him, and mirrors what many Trump campaign officials said privately for many months. The analysis by Tony Fabrizio, a Florida pollster who has worked for Donald Trump for years, was shared among campaign advisors late last year and was provided to the Washington Post on Monday night. Politico first reported on the existence of the document. The states studied were Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Iowa, North Carolina, Ohio, and Texas. Voters in those states overwhelmingly supported a mask mandate, 75%. And Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease specialist, secured an approval rating almost as high. Donald Trump did not support a mask mandate, sometimes mocking the wearing of face masks, and regularly criticized Anthony Fauci, threatening to fire him at times. Advisors repeatedly encourage former President Trump to wear a face mask, stop attacking Anthony Fauci, and signal to the public that he was taking the coronavirus more seriously, particularly after he was hospitalized and given an experimental drug. Donald Trump was largely resistant and mocked the virus down the stretch, sarcastically saying COVID, COVID, COVID at his rallies and falsely predicting that the virus would leave the news after the election. More than 445,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. The report, which groups states into ones Donald Trump held versus ones that were flipped, says voters found Joe Biden more competent to deal with the coronavirus crisis, and in both groups gave him higher marks on being honest. Although Donald Trump dominated among voters focused on the economy, according to the analysis, Joe Biden won coronavirus voters, which was a bigger share. It outlines in specific detail how Donald Trump lost key demographic groups that he needed to win, whilst lauding some of his gains among minority groups. The President of the United States suffered his greatest erosion with white voters, particularly white men, in both state groups. However, he made double-digit gains with Hispanics in both groups, whilst his performance among blacks was virtually the same as in 2016. The President of the United States lost ground with almost every age group in both state groupings, the autopsy reads, adding that the worst loss was among white, college-educated workers. In 2016, Donald Trump won independents by double digits in both the flipped and held groupings. They shifted against him significantly in 2020, though, according to the analysis. Voters over the age of 65 also shifted away from Donald Trump, according to the report. There were several other findings that hurt him, too. Voters who made up their minds in the last month of the campaign narrowly went for Joe Biden over Donald Trump, according to the report, even though Trump hoped to gain steam after his final debate performance. And while Trump spent much of the campaign's final days pushing through Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination, that may have backfired politically. Tony Fabrizio writes, 9 in 10 voters in both groups said that the Supreme Court of the United States was a factor in deciding their vote. Ironically, those who said it was a factor voted for Joe Biden in both state groups, whilst those who said it wasn't a factor voted for the President of the United States by large margins. The analysis says that voters gave former Vice President Mike Pence slightly higher marks over Vice President Kamala Harris, but it wasn't a determining factor.
World with reporters.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei, since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, for on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been at loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions called for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government, but that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profit without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many. It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevailed among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
there are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez Crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate.
Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Al-Dale, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a. Thank you.